Hello and welcome to Table Talk, Spectator Life's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're joined by Skye Gingell, the Australian chef best known for her work as food editor for Vogue and for winning a Michelin star at the Petersham Nurseries Cafe. She's the founder of Spring at Somerset House and the culinary director of Heckfield Place. Skye, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Skye, tell us about food in Australia when you were growing up.
Well, it was very different from here because I suppose everything that kind of grows naturally and happily in Australia is much more tropical. So I grew up in a macrobiotic household, so food was incredibly important in my house, but not particularly delicious. And surrounding me, and when I think about Australia and the food of Australia, I think about tropical fruits, mangoes, avocados, pineapples, light cheese, passion fruit, macadamia nuts, lots of fish, lots of salads. It's pretty easy to be healthy in Australia because the weather's warm, and I think your palate naturally lends them towards kind of healthier, lighter food.
And you'd say you grew up in a macrobiotic household. For those less familiar with macrobiotics, tell us what that was actually like.
Quite challenging, actually. So macrobiotics is a traditional Japanese way of eating that involves 60% grain, but no dairy at all, no meat, very little fish, lots of acidic and fermented foods and whole grains. And so it's quite brown. And we were always trying to escape from home and always eat whatever we could. And so actually probably when we left home, our diet was worse than it should have been because we were so excited to eat anything that was chocolate or sticky iced buns or milkshakes. But it is a kind of diet that's based on health.
And where did the interest in macrobiotics come from? Was it your mother or your father?
No, definitely from my father. And it was a midlife crisis. So in a way, it was even worse because we started life as a normal family.
And then you knew what you were missing.
We knew all the time what we were missing and what it once had been. And then it became something very, very different. And actually around a really challenging age because we were sort of all probably kind of just coming up to our teenage years. So quite rebellious anyway. So they had quite a lot of work on their hands, my parents, to sort of try and convert us.
And what about school food? I mean, did you enjoy school food? Was it a
so school
bit of relief
food in Australia hasn't, we don't have pre-cooked meals. So it's a real culture of taking your own lunch to school, or the real treat if you go to school in Australia is to be allowed to have the tuck shop menu. So you can place an order in. I did love tuck shop, and we were allowed to have it maybe twice a week. And it was sort of meat pies and finger bun, not very good for you food. But we don't have the same culture as providing a meal at school as you do here.
And given the sort of macrobiotic regime that was going on in the household, were mealtimes a big thing? Did you all sit down together to eat the grains?
We did. Yeah. I mean, my father was very often at work until really late. But we would always have a sort of great big pot of brown rice on the go. But we would sit together, the kids and my mother would sit together. Maybe once or twice a week, my father would be home to join us, maybe on the weekends. When I do think of home, though, I do think of sitting down as a family as opposed to all eating separately or in front of the TV.
And at 18, you travelled to Paris, where you trained as a cook.
Yes.
What made you go?
So it was really an accident, and I was definitely not inspired by the food of my house to go and be a cook. I actually started a degree at university, and I got a job washing up in a kitchen to earn money. Mm-hmm. And I completely fell in love with the restaurant kitchens, and particularly the woman who owned the restaurant. She was an incredible mentor. And I was actually doing a law degree, and I decided after the first year, my parents were furious, that I was going to give it up and I was going to try to go to Paris to this very famous school called La Varenne, where actually the lady, Layla, who had been so kind and mentored me, had also been.
And what was that like, being
that
there?
That was so fun. I mean, I was like 18, living in Paris with a whole lot of other friends. We lived in a tiny two-room apartment, and there was about six of us living there. And sharing bedrooms and beds. And it was really, I mean, I loved cookery school, but I also loved living in Paris. And I was very parochial, really. I'd grown up in Australia. So to come to Europe and to see, I just found it all completely intoxicating and really seductive. And I've actually never lived at home since that time.
And does La Varenne teach classical French cookery?
Very classic, yeah. And I'm a big believer in that because I think through the discipline of the classics, you can then have freedom, but it's really important to understand all the techniques.
You need the grounding.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it's like being an artist. It's learning to draw properly, really, before you can experiment. And particularly, there's a science to cooking, which at some level you have to, you can be a wonderful kind of like home cook or sort of throw it together cook. But if you really want to push and go further, you really need to know the techniques.
French food must have been quite different to the food that you're eating in Australia. What were your kind of first impressions of French food when you arrived?
Well, I suppose I'd had all the books. So I started collecting cookery books before I left. And so I sort of knew, I think, what to expect. I mean, for me, it was what I loved so much was I loved the way in the 1980s in Paris, you could eat at 6 a.m. You could have moule and steak at 6 a.m. after you'd been out all night. And just kind of the whole culture of the restaurant and cafe scene, I thought was really amazing. And then I loved going to school. I found that fantastic. I really enjoyed learning how to make puff pastry and how to make a proper stock and how to make a consommé. And so it was an incredible year for me. And I actually stayed on for another 2.5 years after I left and worked in restaurants before I moved to London.
And what brought you to London?
Well, I actually had quite a lot of friends in London because I'd met a lot of English people on, I guess, gap years in Australia. And so I loved living in Paris, but I realised that it wasn't probably practical for me to stay there and actually make a life there. So my father was working in London, and so I really came to kind of, I came for about 3 months, I think I probably thought I was coming for, and then I would go, went home, but sort of life got in the way, and 38 years later, I've never moved back home.
Where were you working when you first came to London?
The first job I had in London was at the Dorchester Hotel under Anton Mosserman, who was the executive chef there.
How was then, that?
That was really scary. And a lot of it was quite shocking to me because I'd fallen in love with cooking and I'd had this incredible mentor. And I sort of thought the cooking that I'd been exposed to was kind of very female and like, it was a beautiful kitchen and the sun shone through. And then to arrive in a hotel kitchen, especially, which are literally in the bowels of the earth, and you don't know if it's 8 a.m. or 11 o'clock at night, there are no windows and you could be in, you know, you could be anywhere in the world. There's no kind of sense of time or place. Yeah. And it was full of, it was 130 people in that kitchen. So I was this sort of tiny little cog in a wheel that just sort of peeled carrots and like washed celery. And I think for a long time, actually, really until I found Petersham Nurseries, I struggled with restaurant kitchens, although that was the thing I first fell in love with. So a lot of the latter part of my career in the last probably 15, 20 years has been working out how to have a restaurant on my terms in the way that I would enjoy. And I definitely think certainly Spring and also Heckfield Place aren't really run in the same way as other kitchen brigades are sort of run.
You're not a fan of the macho brigade system that's traditional in restaurants, are you?
No, and actually the word brigade, escoffier, was the first to term it, but it comes actually from, it was taken from an army word. Mm. And it is very hierarchical and quite sort of militant. And I don't want to work in a place like that. So I certainly don't want to create a restaurant or a kind of environment which is the same.
And tell us about Petersham. What led you there?
Well, Petersham was really a happy accident. You know, I'd actually been out of restaurants for about 4 or 5 years. I had two really little children and I wasn't sure that I actually wanted to ever go back into a restaurant again. And I had started to write and teach and I did some private work. And in many ways, I probably was earning more money than I did in a restaurant and living, being able to stop and start work, you know, around the kids' school holidays and stuff. But the owners, Gail and Francesco Boglioni, were sort of friends of mine. And they asked me if I'd come, they'd purchased this funny old nursery at the end of their garden. And they asked me to go down because they'd cottoned on to the fact that there's no money to be made in a nursery. I mean, you buy sort of bulbs at this time of year and then there's a little rush on again, you know, for all the spring planting. And basically, there's very little else. You know, it's very, very hard. But you can have a restaurant in a garden centre without having an official restaurant licence, which is known as an A3. So they asked me down and I went down and I completely fell in love with it. And it was way prior to opening and it was, they literally just purchased it and it was kind of cement floor, white glass houses, very kind of rickety, selling very, very basic plants. And I came on board right from the beginning. So I was there prior to opening, and it just seemed like it was going to be really fun. We knew that there was an area we could plant a vegetable garden, and I wasn't on the A to Z, and I kind of thought, oh, I'll be cooking here for the summer holidays. No one will come because, you know, and I'll go back to my real life at the end when September came, you know. And actually it just had this kind of, looking back now, I mean, it does seem really extraordinary, and it was probably very zeitgeisty. It was kind of ahead of its time, and it probably seemed very strange to open a restaurant in a garden center. Obviously now you see a lot more of them, and I think people just responded, you know. I mean, you know, all we did was paint the glass houses dark green, and we dug up all the cement on the ground, and Francesco laid something called hoggan, which is like a red earth. And I cooked from a garden shed. And, you know, that's literally all we did. And even sort of 10 years on, before I left, there was very little infrastructure. We still weren't on mains gas. We did move from the garden shed, but we moved next door to Francesco's old Maserati garage. Like, we just bought all our equipment secondhand, and it was a really beautiful time, actually. It was amazing.
You then won a Michelin star.
We
What was that like?
That was really thrilling. I mean, a lot of people have said to me that, I mean, I've heard a lot of things that I gave the, you know, I gave up the Michelin star, which I don't think you can do. I think it's an award. I don't think you can hand it back. It was challenging. And, you know, that's where I think the misinterpretation has come from, because I did say that in an interview 10 years ago, or whenever it was, 9 years ago. And it is, I think what happens is we were just cooking exactly the way we wanted to cook, and you had to queue up in the rain for a loo, and, you know, sometimes we'd forgotten to order the calagas, and it just kind of, you know, and then all of a sudden people came expecting a Michelin-starred experience, which I don't even know what that is. You know, I suppose there's as many different Michelin-starred experiences as there are Michelin-starred restaurants, but I think people have in their head that it's probably white linen table service, and, you know, our tables were completely rickety, and you'd be much better off to wear Wellington boots down there than like stilettos. And it just, what happened was, it was just quite painful, because I used to just keep on getting letters going, call yourself a Michelin starred restaurant. And it was just like, no, we didn't. And then it just felt that people weren't, the stakes got really high, and it just changed.
Did the clientele change after you got it?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And, you know, they are great for business. They really are, you know, and they really put you on the map. And I was I trained in Paris. So if someone had told me when I was a 20-year-old girl that one day you'll have a Michelin star, it would have been like telling an 11-year-old girl, one day you're going to be a princess. You know what I mean? It was like, I was so thrilled to receive it. And I'm still incredibly proud of what we achieved as a team down there. But it does change. It did change it a little bit.
Did you enjoy the challenge of the physical limitations of cooking in a shed and serving in a greenhouse, or was it?
I did for about 9.5 years.
Right.
And then I remember so clearly, you know, when I left, it was literally because I thought, I remember leaning, it was so cold down there in the winter that underneath our chef's jackets we'd wear like full jumpers and kind of heat tech gear, and you'd have to warm up, light all the stoves in the morning to kind of heat the kitchen, and it was always wet. You really, like, you come home with like sort of dirt up to your knees, and I just thought, I don't think I can do this another year. And also I felt like I'd done everything that I could there, and I was ready for another challenge.
You said that when you've been in hotel kitchens and been under the sort of 130 person brigade structures, that it wasn't really the kind of kitchen you wanted to be working in. How did you go about creating a kitchen structure that you were heading up that suited you?
Well, I think one of the first things, I mean, certainly with Spring, was I looked for 2 years to find a restaurant that we could put a kitchen in that was completely light filled, because it's your office, it's where you work every day. So we were really lucky, and we looked for ages to find Somerset House, but we have two kitchens there and they're completely light filled. And then the second decision we made, we decided to close on a Sunday because so many people have kids, and I thought it'd be really nice for everyone to have a day off, knowing every week that they have a day off. And then also, I think the restaurant quite likes a quiet day as well, you know, and have a bit of time off, because otherwise it really gets hammered in a restaurant, you know, like everything, you know, thousands of people walking across it and slamming things, and, you know. And then we only do 6 shifts a week there, which is quite unusual. Like, you can very often you can do 8 shifts a week, and then 8, 9, 10. And then we have a lot of women in the kitchen, and I've really tried to encourage. I don't like a kitchen necessarily with all women, because I think life is about balance and it's really nice to have men and women. But we have 22 chefs at Spring, and currently I think 15 are women. So it's quite a female environment. And then the way we cook is very, although I learned all of those techniques, the more I've gone on, the simpler my food has become. So we really try to focus on organic, biodynamic, produce from good, clean soil. We've really tried to look at the environment and how we can be positive in changing some of the things in our industry. So we went single-use plastic-free in 2018.
The first restaurant in the UK to do that. I've read about this and it's amazing. But how do you not use cling film?
Well, I think what was really, when we decided to go, because there's lots of areas you use plastic in or single-use plastic in a restaurant, cling film would be the most extensive and most obvious. And so what we did was we gathered statistics together. So, and I think they, for us, that was really powerful. So we worked out how much cling film we ordered in a year. And then once we worked that out, we put it into kilometres. And we worked out that we used 800 kilometres of cling film a year, which is the length of England right up to kind of the end of Scotland. And then we realised that there were 15,000 food and beverage outlets in London approximately. So if all of them used the same as us, that would be 12.5 million kilometres of cling film from one city in one country in the world. So that makes it really easy to think you've got to do something about it. And we literally went cold turkey. We stopped buying it, and we did the most, it's actually very easy, and what you do is buy lids for everything.
So radical.
So we bought lids for everything, and we do use a bit of something called beeswrap a little bit, and we use something called cellulose, which kind of mimics, it's veg compostable material that mimics cling film. Not really as clingy as cling film, but we've even used that less and less. We outlaid about, I think it cost us £1,800 to convert. I mean, we did it on everything from ice cream cups to, obviously, we'd actually given up straws in 2017, but we took 6 items, single-use items, and we eradicated them from. And then any plastic we do have, and so it is really important to say it's single-use plastic, so that's a water bottle. It's not necessarily Tupperware. And so all the plastic that we did have, we haven't bought anymore, but we've really consciously looked after it and kept it in the system.
You mentioned biodynamic farming earlier, and Heckfield Place is biodynamic. What can you explain what exactly biodynamic farming is?
So Heckfield, it's in conversion, and we just received organic status last Tuesday. So that took 2 years, and then we have one more year before we reach full biodynamic status, although we have been practicing biodynamics for 3.5 years on that land. So what it is it is organic, but it's actually just following a principle that was developed by Rudolf Steiner. And it comes from a series of 6 lectures he gave on one day in 1927. And it's basically, it's organic, but with following the lunar calendar. So you have special planting days and fertilizing days. It has a really strong calendar that completely follows the cycle of the moon. And I know it sounds maybe a bit crazy. And someone said to me the other day, they were like, where's the scientific fact? Actually, it was a kind of political journalist. He's like, where's the science behind that? And there probably is a certain amount of science, and then there probably is a certain amount of care that makes all the difference. But it does really taste delicious. And there is no doubt in my mind that food that's grown in nutrient-dense, healthy soil tastes better. And it's really important for the environment. I mean, we really have to look to regenerative agriculture, and all of us need to kind of start stepping away from the industrialised agricultural system.
Tell us about cooking at home.
Yeah.
Do you have much opportunity to cook at home when you run a restaurant?
My number one first joy, if I'm really honest, is not to give a dinner party. And I think home is very much a kind of place of refuge for me, and I probably spend about 14 hours a day either at Heckfield or at Spring, and I do cook every night very, very simply. And so we I haven't had any meat in the house probably for about 10 years. It's not because I don't eat meat, and I do really love it sometimes, but I don't feel like none of us need to eat the meat in the quantities that we're eating it. And I basically, what's really interesting is I think that influence of macrobiotics all those years ago has really shown in my work now. So I eat a lot of whole grains. I have an amazing pantry that's full of everything, like from chickpeas to farro to brown rice to and really good olive oils. And I will make probably grains and vegetables for dinner. And it's what I feel like eating, lashings of olive oil. And I very often cook one pot on a Sunday. We did a huge food waste initiative at Spring in 2016, actually. And when I started looking into food waste, I always I make sure that everything I buy, I find a use for. So I have a great pantry, and then I top up almost daily on the way home. Like sometimes I just grab a tomato and a loaf of really good rye bread. Like if it's, I eat so simply, and I've been around food all day. I don't need anything fancy pants. You know, I just want something that tastes good for me.
What about comfort food? Is it, do you prefer to cook for yourself for comfort food, or is there something from your childhood that you would want?
So my go-to comfort food will always be bread and cheese. I could live off a really good like rye bread or sourdough, and that is my kind of like, definitely that's my, not naughty, it is probably naughty because I could honestly put as much butter on it as I could put cheese. I adore dairy, but comfort food to me would definitely be, I can't honestly say that comfort food comes from my childhood. But like a really good soup with bread and like slathered in butter and really good olive oil. Like comfort food to me is knowing, it might sound crazy, but it really is something that feels like it's nurturing my body. I really don't like eating food that I feel is poisoning me. So I love a good, really good chicken stew. Anything slow cooked is like one of my favorite things.
Do you have a sweet tooth?
Occasionally. Yeah, like in general, no. So I wouldn't want something sweet every day. But then there's just a time, often when I'm very tired. And then, yeah, I could definitely, yeah, a little bit of chocolate. But I love anything with custard, actually. Yeah.
Skye, thank you so much for joining our podcast.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.